Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this evening's keynote speech. I'm delighted to introduce Professor Sir Richard Evans, who is Regius Professor of History and President of Walsham College at Cambridge. He's had a long and prestigious career. He was Professor of History at Birkbeck College, London from 1989 to 1998 and Vice Master of the College from 1993 to 97. He's a Fellow of the British Academy and has been active on their committees. Richard has been awarded a number of highly prestigious research fellowships and has been a visiting fellow at a number of European universities. In 2000, he was elected Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, and in 2010 was appointed one of the founding fellows of the Learned Society of Wales. In 2005 and 2006, Richard was a history honoree in the Los Angeles Times Book Awards. This honour was for the second and third volumes of his Third Reich trilogy, and it involved being flown out for an Oscars-style ceremony in LA. And if you asked Richard, he would tell you it was great fun. Now, whilst best known for his writing on the 19th and 20th century European history, Richard has also been a great defender of history in schools. He is one of those academic historians who has taken the time to research and to understand school history. His articles on the topic have been much enjoyed and appreciated by teachers, and a number of recent pieces on the national curriculum can be seen on the display boards here at the conference at our exhibition. This evening, he's speaking to us on writing the history of 19th century Europe. Welcome, Richard.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you very much for inviting me to this conference. It's wonderful to be here. I haven't spoken to the Historical Association for more than 20 years, and the last time I did, it was to a branch at a school which I will not mention. And there were about five people in the audience. There was a retired colonel, two old ladies, and a couple of schoolgirls who had been brought along by their teacher, who was the secretary of the local branch. So I sort of chatted to them rather than giving a formal lecture. And at the end, I said to the secretary of the branch, there's not very many people here tonight. And he said, oh, no, it's not always like this. Last month, we had Professor Scarisbrick, and there were 24 people there. But then he's a big name. So that put me firmly in. So it's wonderful to see so many of you here this evening. Now, I was going to bring some Mr. Men books along. My younger son is taking GCSEs next year, and so I went and looked at his bookshelves, but I'm afraid he's more into Game of Thrones. So I couldn't do that. But it's astonishing to hear and read Michael Gove's speech earlier this week in Brighton, which is a masterpiece of political distortion, it seems to me. The Mr. Men books are not used for GCSE teaching. They're used in a school in Toulouse, an international school for IGCSE, which is a school that ends its curriculum, ends its teaching of the Nazis by asking the kids to imagine that they're teaching 5 or 6 year olds or 7 year olds and how best to get the Nazis across, and suggest they might like to think of Mr. Men. So it's not being used actually as a teaching tool for GCSE at all, and certainly not in this country. And similarly, the Historical Association has been very much able to defend itself against Mr. Gove's allegations that it teaches history through Disney cartoons. It's puzzling to know why he's really done that. In the light of all the debates about the draft national curriculum, I'm beginning to feel like a bit of a dinosaur, because I teach European history and I've done so all my career. And if the draft curriculum comes into force, and if the same principles of concentrating exclusively on British history are extended to GCSE and A level, which is now currently under discussion in the Department for Education and Skills, then the kind of history I write will no longer appear in schools at all. Nevertheless, there is an enormous market out there amongst grown-ups and people who love history generally for books on European history of all sorts. So this is really what inspired Penguin to commission, under the editorship of David Cannadine, a series of books the Penguin History of Europe in 10 volumes from start to finish, as it were. This happened about 20 years ago, and the idea was that this would be the same as the old Penguin History of England. Some of you will probably remember those wonderful volumes by Bindoff and Whitelock, and not quite so wonderful ones by David Thompson, but a very interesting series, short books, no footnotes, and so on. And that was the general idea. So David Cannadine asked us, we all duly signed our contracts. Now, at that time, I felt I was mostly teaching 19th century history. That was my main field. And so David Cannadine asked me to write the volume on 19th century Europe. And the original idea was going to be 1789 to 1914, but I avoided the French Revolution most of my career because it's so complicated. modern German history is much easier to understand in some ways. And so Tim Blanning, who was writing the previous volume, I approached him and I said, "Look, Tim, you know far more about the French Revolution than I do. You're a real expert. Why don't you take your volume up to 1815? He said, "Oh, yes, all right, I'll do that then." So I think he was a bit flattered, so he did. One of the things I want to show in this talk is really how writing history is often there are odd sort of chances that come into it, because we sort of thought about it, started preparing, started reading around and so on. And then just a few years later, in the later 1990s, I got drawn into the David Irving, Deborah Lipsat, Penguin libel case over Holocaust denial, which took up nearly 4 years of my life. So I had to put the Penguin history on one side. And when I came back to think about it, I'd been, by that time, all sorts of things had happened. I had changed my agent and signed up with a man known as the Jackal, Andrew Wiley, who persuaded me to write a history of Nazi Germany, which then became, from one volume, became three volumes. I didn't finish it until 2008. So by that time, a lot of time had passed, and the historical landscape in terms of commercial publishing had changed dramatically. The history boom began in the late 1990s, and history became enormously popular. Both academic crossover writers, academics who write for a broader public as well as for other academics, and I count myself as one of those, academics who became popular writers, like Neil Ferguson or David Starkey, and tied in their history books to the TV series. Popular writers who wrote academically respectable books, which became bestsellers, like Max Hastings or Anthony Beaver. There's a massive history boom. And the one thing that the commercial publisher like Penguin realized was that big books sell. So all of a sudden, our 120,000 word histories became 280,000 word histories. Penguin just turned around and said, "Could you give us 280,000 words, please?" Now, this had two effects, really. The first effect was a very good one, which was that you can kind of expand a bit. You can make it more interesting. It doesn't have to be a sort of lapidary. You can get in interesting detail. You can let yourself go a little bit within the structure you build for yourself. But the second thing, of course, it takes a lot longer to write a longer book. So it wasn't until just 3 or 4 years ago that volumes in the series started appearing, apart from one innocent American William Chester Jordan, who turned in his volume on the High Middle Ages to length, 120,000 words, and on time. But none of the rest of us managed to do that. It's partly because, to be quite frank, Penguin, the original series, before the history boom, had not offered very large advances, whereas in the history boom, sometimes Penguin themselves paid some of us a lot more money to write completely different books, so it was partly their own fault. I remember we had a seminar on this in Cambridge a couple of years ago, and Tim, where the editor, Simon Winder, was there, and Tim Blanning he was asked by Simon Winder why it had taken so long to write his volume. And he said, "Well, here is the contract," and he produced a legal foolscap with pen emendations on it. "That is a very old-fashioned contract for a very old-fashioned advance," he said. So we came back to this series, I think, having lots of things having changed in the meantime. And one of the things, as I'll say in a minute, that changed dramatically in the meantime was the way in which people approach European history, indeed history in general. Fashions change. We go through so many turns, the cultural turn, the linguistic turn, the transnational turn. We're all, our heads are spinning. But there have been very many new developments in history. And that, in the end, I concluded, was an enormous advantage. I'm very glad that I waited 20 years to write this book. Now, 1815 to 1914, and it follows on from Tim Blanding's A Pursuit of Glory, which covers 1648 to 1815, and is an absolutely wonderful book, tremendously readable, and it has all the great qualities that Blanding displays. And as Blanding remarks, while every history of Europe has to start at some arbitrary date, some dates are more arbitrary than others. We speak habitually of the 19th century or the 20th century, but historians know that the period 1801 to 1900 has no real meaning beyond the merely chronological. History is full of loose ends. Even the outbreak and conclusion of major wars that so often provide the terminal dates for histories covering discrete segments of the European past, including this one that I'm dealing with, leave many issues unresolved, even in the field of politics and warfare. Many years ago, when politics, warfare, and diplomacy dominated the writing of history, periodization seemed pretty obvious to most historians, even if they're already aware of the fact that the narrative of history moves across the great punctuation marks of wars, revolutions, and peace treaties with a kind of callous disregard for the practical challenge faced by the historian who had to start somewhere and stop somewhere. The challenge got all the greater, I think, because history as a subject has expanded so much in the last half century or more to encompass so many areas of human activity, from society to culture, religion to philosophy, economy to everyday life. And of course, different aspects of history have different chronologies. A date that has a meaning in political or military or diplomatic history may have very little in social, economic, or cultural history. And feminist historians, of course, argue that women's history chronology is completely different from that of the rest of history. Long ago, the great French historian Fernand Braudel likened the movement of history to the movement of the sea, with the deepest layers of geography and landscape, such determining factors in a society where most people lived off the land, barely moving at all, immobile history, they call it. The middle-level currents of economies and societies pushing forward slowly but discernibly. At the top, the choppy waters and foamy waves of politics, powerless to influence the more profound movement of the waters below. Now, French historians, following in his wake, became accustomed to speaking of immobile history, which persisted well into modern times in many parts of Europe. Jean Dulumeau's great history of fear in Europe, for example, goes in the Middle Ages right up to the middle of the 19th century, where nothing much, in his view, changes. And despite the fall of the Ancien Régime in European political systems at the end of the 18th century, the Ancien Régime économique et social persisted well into the second half of the 19th. And some historians, like Arnaud Meyer in his book The Persistence of the Ancien Régime, have argued that the dominance of traditional aristocratic elites remained all the way up to the First World War, so that not much of significance changed in politics either. Well, I think Arnaud Meyer's views have not been widely accepted by historians. There's a lot to discuss in them, I think. Historical change there was in 19th century Europe, not just in politics, but in other areas too. And some indeed have decided that the most meaningful period to study is that of the Age of Revolution, to quote the first volume of Eric Hobsbawm's celebrated survey of the years 1780 to 1848. The Age of Revolution, when Europe experienced repeated radical, violent political upheavals, lasted, in this view, from the First French Revolution, preceded by the American Revolution, and on through to the European revolutions of 1848. The Europe of these years was, to quote the title of Jonathan Sperber's survey of the period from 1780 to 1850, revolutionary Europe. And if you believe, as Hobsbawm did, that political upheavals are in the last analysis, the product of social and economic changes, then this enables historians to link together the many different dimensions of history in a single framework, welded together by the concept of revolution. Now, obviously, this has become a lot more difficult in the post-Marxist world of today, and there's a price to pay for choosing these years, because what came after was a very different Europe, one much less easy to conceptualise in a single framework. And not by chance, Sperber's follow-up volume has a wordy title that conveys, I think probably unconsciously, the difficulty found in solving this problem. Europe, 1850 to 1914, Progress, Participation and Apprehension. I'm not sure what that actually means, but it's clear it's very different from the simple idea of 1780 to 1850 as the Age of Revolution. Well, Eric Hobsbawm went on to write two more volumes, The Age of Capital, 1848-1870, and The Age of Empire, taking the story up to the First World War. And anyone who tries to write the history of 19th century Europe, as I am now, has to confront these three terrific volumes, which tower over the literature on the subject. In all three cases, the binding concept makes sense, given the author's belief about how history works. And with his uncanny gift for conceptual innovation, Hobsbawm went on to characterise the whole period covered by his trilogy as the long 19th century, 1789 to 1914. The original vision, of course, of David Cannadine and Penguin when they commissioned the series, which I managed to evade for purely selfish reasons, and or William Simpson and Martin Jones's useful study of Europe, 1783 to 1914, or the Blackwell Companion to 19th Century Europe, 1789 to 1914, or Michael Rapport's 19th Century Europe, 1789 to 1914, and you can find many others doing the long 19th century. But the problem there is that this 19th century is a broken-backed century. It's divided into two different halves, the two halves covered by Sperber in his two volumes, by the 1848 revolutions. And not surprisingly, again, many historians covering the period, even from the Battle of Waterloo to the outbreak of the First World War, have given up the attempt to find any kind of conceptual unity and chosen titles like R.S. Alexander's Europe's Uncertain Path. But the enormous advantage I found accrued by the series of chances that delayed my making a start in this book for nearly two decades was that a way round these seemingly impassable conceptual obstacles has appeared in the meantime. Through most of the 20th century, historians regarded the rise of nation-states and the conflicts between them as the central features of European history in the 19th century. The triumph of nationalism forged new political and cultural entities and inspired revolts against large and, it seemed, outmoded multinational empires, revolts against oppression by other nationalities or ambitions to achieve dominance over them. And this model of the nation-state was then exported across the globe in the 20th century, making its emergence in Europe in the 19th seem even more important. And many historians initially saw this process in positive terms. So if you look back far enough before the Second World War, you can see histories of Europe, Grant and Temperley and so on, putting celebratory accounts of the unification of Italy and Germany, the growth of Czech and Polish national consciousness and so on, at the centre of their narrative. But of course, this ethnic and national rivalry spilled over into the horrendous violence of World War II. From the perspective of the second half of the 19th century, the rise of nationalism appeared in a much darker light. Historians now wanted to look back over the previous century or more and trace the developments that culminated in a global conflict between nations centred in Europe, indeed two global conflicts, 1914-18, 1939-45. But since those days, really since, I think, the mid-1990s, we've become aware that we're living in an age of rapidly increasing globalisation, as international institutions, global means of communication, such as the internet, multinational companies and their products, many other influences, have crossed national boundaries and begun to bind us all together in a global human community. And since the turn of the century, this has altered, I think, increasingly our vision of the past, in which historians come to see more and more in a global perspective. Of course, the idea that European history has to be seen in a global context isn't new. In 1986, interestingly, History Today asked a number of historians to what is history, looking back to E.H. Carr's book from 1961. And the French historian Marc Ferro took the opportunity to polemicise against the concept of European history that, he said, is history seen solely with the eyes of Europe and with a European vision of history. So this is indefensible because it served to justify European supremacy. And it reflected, he said, the self-interest of the European bourgeoisie, of which historians, of course, are a part. And the post-colonial age, he warned, European history can only have meaning, and I'm quoting here, insofar as it compares collective behaviour in Europe and beyond, without the rest of the world, with which Europe must compare itself, European history will have no other function than to make Europe's presence invisible to the rest of the world and isolate it still further. But Ferro's proposal was really more for a comparative global history than for a global history that brought different parts of the world together. And this only happened more recently, as historians have begun, for example, to look at the effects of empire on European economies, societies, cultures, and political systems, notably but not only those of Britain, to look at the global economic ties that bound Europe to other parts of the world in a nexus of mutual interaction, to the genesis of colonial knowledge and its reception and influence in the colonising nations, the rise of the worldwide empire, particularly as a common European process rather than specific to any particular European nation. Historians have been rewriting the history of individual European nations, therefore, in a global context, emphasising the effects of European diasporas, of the mass migration of millions of Europeans to other parts of the globe in the 19th century in particular, and the influence of that on the mother country, the infusion of European nationalism with elements of racial theory derived from the experience of colonisation in Africa or Asia, the emergence of geopolitics as a key factor in relations between European states and the way in which European statesmen and military and naval thinkers considered it. Now, look, of course, major books have appeared on the global history of the 19th century and of modern times. One by the German historian Jürgen Osterhammel, The Transformation of the World, is a global history, a real global history of the 19th century, not a Eurocentric one like Hobsbawm's volumes. It's over 1,000 pages long. It's in the process of being translated into English. It's taking a long time, of course. It covers the 19th century, and it covers an extraordinary number of topics: memory and self-observation, time, space, mobility, living standards, cities, frontiers, power, revolution, the state, energy, work, communications, hierarchy, knowledge, civilization, religion, and so on. And reading, rather dipping into this book at key moments, because it's a book that you, I think, it's not meant to be read from beginning to end. You consult it, as it were, but it's had a lot of influence in the way I'm approaching my task. It deliberately picks out common themes, connections between different parts of the globe, shared developments, global processes. Osterhammel is a German writer, but he's actually a Chinese history specialist, so this is a very kind of interesting, the two sort of rub up against the other in interesting ways. But its global coverage, I think, is bought at the expense of empirical detail, and it's that which is pretty thin, really. It doesn't give the reader the feel of the period, and the author's argumentative presence eclipses that of the people who lived in the time he's writing about. And what I want to do in my history of 19th century Europe is to bring out the experience of the people who lived there, to make a lot of quotes from the individuals, to give life histories. I start each chapter with the story of one particular person, whether it's a Russian serf or a German soldier or a French political theorist, to start by a life story that's illustrative in some way and to keep bringing back examples of the actual people who lived at the time. Too often, I think, historical surveys spend all their time establishing the broad contours of interpretation without trying to convey the lived experience of contemporaries. Now, that's why 280,000 words for me is better than 120,000, because that allows me to do it. 120,000 would be little more than a textbook whose ultimate purpose would be to help students prepare for exams, but a more extensive work aimed in the first place at the reader who's new to the period, the general reader, I think has the space to convey the detail, the period flavour in all its strangeness and familiarity, and to allow contemporaries to a high degree to speak for themselves rather than just reducing them, as I think is the case with Osterhammel's book, to ventriloquist dummies by speaking through them with the voice of the historian, or even reducing them to silence. Now, there's some other no less ambitious works of global history written about the same time in the last 5 or 6 years with a different approach. Historians like John Darwin in his wonderful survey of global empires after Tamerlane, or Chris Bailey in his equally impressive The Making of the Modern World, have established, I think, with a wealth of comparative evidence, the rough equality in almost every respect, from living standards to cultural achievements, of a whole range of civilizations across the world up to round about the middle of the 18th century. Mughal Empire in India, the Qing Empire in China, the great colonial, pre-colonial empires of Benin and its neighbors in Africa, the Ottoman Empire, other states were roughly on a par with Europe by around 1750. But by 1815, just a short time afterwards, this is no longer the case. Europe's forged ahead. Not, I think, as some historians, notably Neil Ferguson, have maintained, because of its intrinsic superiority, but because of some quite specific historical circumstances, and those I want to analyse in the book. Europe maintained and extended its advantage on many fronts right up to the early years of the 20th century, though it became increasingly under attack. First World War put it into question, the Second World War destroyed it, bringing down the global European empires in its aftermath. And this global hegemony of Europe between the quite specific dates of 1815 and 1914 is now, I think, the main justification for taking these years as a distinct and meaningful period of European history. So what I want to do through the book is to emphasize the global context, to bring events and processes on other continents into the narrative as a way of helping to explain what was happening in Europe during these decades. In fact, I begin with the great famine of 1815 to 1816, which is caused by an Indonesian volcano covering the earth with a film of dust for a couple of years. Global history, I think, also means transnational history. They're not necessarily with homogenizing tendencies you can see in Osterhammel's work, trying to make all the countries seem the same. Quite a few histories of Europe or periods of European history have consisted of largely separate narratives of different national histories. Going back a long way, Grant and Temperley's Europe in the 19th Century, published in 1927, falls into this category. Simpson and Jones's textbook on the long 19th century, published in 2000, the same, with separate chapters on France, Germany, Italy, Russia, and the Habsburg Monarchy. And the German historian Michel Salevsky's History of Europe is actually entitled States and Nations from the Ancient World to the Present, and is just a series of histories of individual nations and states and their relations. So you see, sort of jumps from one country to another in a breathless fashion, and you don't get any sense of what bound Europe together as a whole, or what Europeans had in common, or what wider processes affected them. And the long-established and still incomplete Oxford History of Modern Europe, which began in 1954 with A.G.B. Taylor's Struggle for Mastery in Europe, and is still being published, they do things very slowly in Oxford, takes a similar approach, with every volume devoted to a single country, except for the four that cover relations between them. Well, now, this is a kind of dilemma in writing this history, because you can't avoid altogether dealing with key aspects of national histories, especially politically. So in my first chapter, I've got to deal with the war for Greek independence, for example, in the 1820s, or the revolutionary conflicts in Spain. Later on in the second chapter, I have to deal with, when I look at economies and societies, with the abolition of serfdom in Russia and so on, and you've got to deal with the unification of Italy, etc. And a further difficulty is, of course, that research has been carried out overwhelmingly within national boundaries. Statistical information on the continent's history in the 19th century is divided up between nations again because of the way it was generated. You can't ignore differences between countries entirely. And just as important, you can't confine the history of Europe to events and processes in a few major states. So I made a conscious effort to bring in what you might call the periphery, from Iceland to Bosnia, Estonia to Portugal. Norman Davis, in his lively Europe, A History, insisted on the enormous weight of territory and population carried by Eastern Europe, above all in the 19th and 20th centuries, and in the 19th century, particularly the Russian Empire. He tried to express this, as you probably know, by printing his maps of Europe sideways on, presenting the reader with a Russian Empire that filled the bottom half of the page, with the rest of Europe sort of squashed towards the top. So in taking an approach that's, as far as possible, transnational and trying to cope with all the different parts of Europe, I'm consciously following the example of Lord Acton, the founder of the Cambridge Modern History at the end of the 19th century. And this is his plan for this ambitious enterprise. Acton told his contributors, and I quote, "Universal history is not the sum of all particular histories and ought to be contemplated first in its distinctive essence, as Renaissance, Reformation, religious wars, absolute monarchy, revolution, etc. Several countries may or may not contribute to feed the mainstream, but attention ought not to be dispersed by putting Portugal, Transylvania, Iceland side by side with France and Germany. My plan," he said, "is to break through the mere juxtaposition of national histories and to take in, as far as may be, what is extraterritorial and universal." And I'm trying as far as possible to follow this very ambitious recipe. Acton, of course, is born in Naples to a Catholic family living in Italy. He's half German, he's educated in France, and he lived in England. He's thoroughly multinational and multicultural in his outlook, and he detested nationalism, saw European history as a whole in the round. Not, I think, now because he was, as Hugh Trevor Roper once said, one of the great Victorian misfits. On the contrary, I think now he was writing in an age when globalization was for the first time sweeping across the continent, with growing global interlinkages between national economies and a vast phalanx of international organizations and communication networks of very recent creation, from the telegraph, transatlantic telegraph, to the World Council of Women, and many, many international, multinational organizations very much in evidence. And this world created in the late 19th century would be severely damaged in 1914 and not be effectively recreated until the later decades of the 20th century. And that, I think, explains why the Acton's ambition was not really fulfilled. He was extraordinarily perceptive, I think. Also in the dark forebodings he had about the role that might be played in the future by German nationalism. He wasn't a romantic, feeling nostalgic about empires soon to disappear. And of course, he died before he could fill the plan, and the Cambridge Modern History was eventually published under the workmanlike but unimaginative editorship of Sir Adolphus Ward, and did largely adopt a country-by-country approach, reflecting the nation-based vision of a younger generation of historians and a changed cultural, political, intellectual atmosphere of the Europe they inhabited. Acton, I think, was a peripheral figure not so much to his age as to the historical profession, which had grown up earlier in the century as part of the emergence of national consciousness and identity. And each country served in particular the function of excavating and legitimating the national past. So historians then concentrated their attention above all on their own nation's past, and in that sense, Acton was an exception. Of course, this hadn't always been the case. In particular, the 18th century Enlightenment strengthened earlier ideas of Europe as the heir of classical civilization, and put them into effect in broad histories of the continent, reflecting the unity of the Republic of Letters at their own time. Voltaire noted that all European states shared, he said, the same principle of public law and politics unknown in other parts of the world. No European, wrote Edmund Burke, can be a complete exile in any part of Europe. And uniting European culture in this era was not only the legacy of ancient Greece and Rome for the educated elites, but also the dominant model of French civilization imitated and adopted in the 18th century from Edinburgh to St. Petersburg. And the concept of a Europe resting on a shared legacy of civilization derived ultimately from ancient Greece and Rome was articulated in what was probably the first genuine attempt at European history by the Scottish intellectual William Robertson, namely the history of the reign of the Emperor Charles V, published in 1769. Previous histories of Europe, like Giambellari's The History of Europe in 1566, or Guicciardini's commentary on the most notable events in Europe in 1656, had treated a more or less arbitrary collection of local and regional events and didn't have any unifying, synthesizing approach, and Robertson was the first to attempt that. He saw the era which he was writing about of Charles V in the 16th century as the founding period of a modern secular Europe, creating a great European family of nations whose relations with one another were governed by the great system of the balance of power, he said, stretching from England to Russia. The European feudal nobility was declining in power and was being replaced by the emergence of the modern state. The Reformation and the ensuing religious conflicts and wars were, in Robertson's view, expressions of a primitive and emotional state of mind, which, with the help of the modern state and the Enlightenment, had been replaced in his own time by politeness, sensibility, good manners, and civilization. Well, that view didn't last much beyond the French Revolution, of course, and with the rise of nation states, the idea of a common European culture deriving from the ancient Greek and Latin classics receded from view. And after the Second World War, the division of Europe by the Iron Curtain made it even more difficult to revive. And certainly with the fall of communism, the extension of the European Union to Eastern Europe, and the onward and the renewed onward march of globalization, that the possibility of writing a real European history reemerges if one considers Europe as the kind of Western part of the Eurasian landmass west of the Urals and west of the Bosporus. It's no longer possible to write it, though, as Grant and Temple and their counterparts elsewhere tried to do, as the history of international relations and politics. As I said, since the 1970s at least, historical investigation has expanded its field of vision until it encompasses almost every part of human activity in the past and some non-human as well in histories of the environment, for example. Already in the early 60s, 1962, Hobsbawm's Age of Revolution had chapters on religion, ideology, science, the arts, the economy, and a lot else besides. And as Osterhammel's list of topics I've quoted suggests, it's extended even further now. Hobsbawm had his overarching master narrative that placed the development of capitalism at its centre. But historians of the early 21st century, when the grand master narratives have fallen into disrepute, have no such luxury. The most we can do, as Tim Blanning says, is to trace lines of development. This means identifying survivals from earlier ages, such as in my volume, Serfdom, obviously, just as much as it means identifying the beginnings of development that continue to affect us, usually in much greater measure in our own time, such as environmental pollution. Two of Blanning's main lines of development, what he calls the relentless march of the states to hegemony and the emergence of a new kind of cultural space, the public sphere, continued through the 19th century and achieved an expansion and dominance that were almost unthinkable in the 18th. I think one of the things you've got to do when you're writing a book in a series is, although you can't assume, and it's probably unlikely that people read the whole series from beginning to end, nevertheless, you have to sort of bounce yourself off the previous volume. And try and pick up some of its themes. So it does appear that in some sense you're writing about the same kind of subject. Well, what about the state structures of restoration in Europe than I have to begin with. I think they would have been familiar to the continent's inhabitants of 50 years previously, I think in many ways, many of their appearances. So the power and intrusiveness of the state are still relatively limited. Popular participation in politics is still pretty minimal, despite the still vivid memories of the French Revolution. The public sphere is still confined mostly to a small stratum of the educated and the literate and their institutions, from the periodical publication to the coffee house and the reading club and the salon. By 1914, the state had been transformed. The universal male and some places in the continent, such as Norway and Finland, even female suffrage, direct popular participation in the shaping of national, regional, and local policy on the one hand, not least through organized political parties, an enormous expansion in the control the state could exercise over its citizens in areas ranging from education to health, military service, and social work as well. And the linked processes of the improvement of communication and the growth of the economy delineated by Blanning for the 18th century accelerated faster in the 19th century than anyone previously could have imagined. In 1815, the railway, the telegraph, the steamship, and the photograph were barely visible over the historical horizon. By 1914, Europe was entering the age of the telephone, the motor car, the radio, the cinema, and the aeroplane. By 1815, we're still in the age of the Newtonian understanding of the universe, of representational art and classical music. By 1914, Einstein's propounded his theory of relativity, Picasso's painted his cubist works, Schoenberg has composed his first atonal music. On the other hand, of course, it's also, in an even more immediate sense, Europe is also entering the age of the machine gun, the tank, submarine, and the fighter plane. First aerial bombardment of an enemy force was recorded in 1911 during the Italian invasion of Libya. The first concentration camps had been opened in South Africa by the British and in Southwest Africa by the Germans, and in America, in Cuba by the Americans. Such developments, foreshadowing the immense violence and destructiveness of the first half of the 20th century, I think stand as a warning against treating the 19th, as most of its inhabitants treated it, as an age of linear progress and open-ended development. Progress had its price, and between 1914 and 45, Europe paid it in full measure. Blanning's volume ends on a gloomy note as far as the condition of life of the vast majority of Europeans is concerned, with the beginnings of industry and the effects of rapid population growth, bringing a new kind of poverty, as he says, not a sudden affliction by plague, famine, or war, but a permanent state of malnutrition and underemployment. And the 19th century, as he hints here, I think, was relatively free of major European wars, an enormous contrast to the 18th century, and explaining that's one of the things I have to do. Change relationship of Europe with the rest of the world is an important determining factor here, I think, it's really British dominance of the seas and of the world, and in fact the British elimination of French competition in North America and India are major factors in this relatively peaceful process. And of course the fear of revolution, the knowledge that wars are deeply destabilizing, something that constantly, repeatedly brings European states together in the 19th century, whether through the Congress system or the Continent of Europe, whatever mechanisms they have. Famines there were, notably in Ireland, Scandinavia, and Russia, and plagues too, in the form of periodic outbreaks of cholera that swept the continent, but these too were neither so frequent nor so devastating as they had been in previous eras. The largest of all the plagues in the 19th century was right at the beginning, accompanying the famine of 1815-16, in which some 500,000 people are thought to have died in Bosnia of bubonic plague, crowding together, fleeing the famine in the countryside, crowding together in towns, and then being exposed to the disease coming from Turkey. By the end of the century, these great epidemics had largely vanished from Europe, though of course they were going to recur with the influenza epidemic of 1918-19. But this didn't mean that social, economic, and other forms of inequality vanished along with them. And running through my book will be the representation of the shifting contours of inequality in the 19th century, with older forms like serfdom on the land giving way to newer ones like wage labour in the factory. The 19th century, you can see, I think, as an age of emancipation, with millions of people being given greater equality of status, including in key respects the majority of the population, women. And what I want to do is to explore these enormous changes and how they came about. But this equality and emancipation, of course, are only ever very partial and very conditional. And the years after 1914 were to demonstrate that. And again, I think I have to explain the limitations they experienced. Arguments and disputes about inequality at the centre of 19th century European politics, and building on the legacy of ideas bequeathed by the French Revolution, increasing numbers of political thinkers and actors began to conceive and tried to implement ways and means of overcoming the inequalities they witnessed. Spectrum of solutions ranged from aristocratic paternalism, the sense of noblesse oblige at one extreme, to the anarchist attempt to destroy the state at the other. Socialism, liberalism, communism, nationalism, many other doctrines prioritise one method or another of freeing people from the yoke of oppression and exploitation according to how they defined it. Those who put order and hierarchy first recognised they couldn't survive simply by clinging to the old order, or at least most of them did. So they too became participants in a great debate on inequality. And religions offered a variety of solutions rooted in the temporal world or advocated escape from it altogether. What all these many different strands of thought had in common, I think, was a desire to acquire and wield power so they could put their ideas into action. So while Tim Blanning calls his History of Europe from 1648 to 1815 the pursuit of glory, signifying the priorities of the dominant political elites of the age, my book will have the title The Pursuit of Power. And the pursuit of power permeated European society in the 19th century. Some states grasped for world power, governments reached out for imperial power, armies built up their military power, revolutionaries plotted to grab power, political parties campaigned to come to power, bankers and industrialists strove for economic power, labour unions went on strike for more power over wages and conditions of work. Modernist artists challenged the power of the academies. Medical researchers reached out in their laboratories for power over disease. Engineers and planners extended humankind's power over nature. In a different sense, scientists and mechanics devised and exploited new sources of power, from steam to electricity, the power loom to the internal combustion engine. Power could be formal or informal, could be exercised through violence or persuasion, could be consensual or majoritarian, might take economic or social or cultural or political or religious or organisational or a host of other forms. But as the 19th century progressed, people increasingly prioritised it over glory, honour and comparable values that had been dominant for many centuries before. And how and why this came to be and how power relations in Europe affected and were affected by power relations between Europe and the rest of the world is a central theme of the book. So far, I've only managed to write two chapters out of eight. I've got two of them roughly, two more roughly drafted, but obviously it's a very complicated and ambitious thing to do. But it's very nice to get back from spending a decade or more on the Third Reich to a more civilized times in 19th century Europe, and to raise my be challenged by having to raise my gaze from Germany itself to look in a much more wider current. So the aim is to finish by the end of this calendar year, if I possibly can, or at least in a year's time, that it'll be on the markets around about 2014 or 2015. That will mean that it will only be about 25 years out after I was actually commissioned to write it, but that's the way things go, and I hope that it will be directed again at a broad readership. But if it's anything to go by with my books on the Third Reich, it will also be used in teaching. Though I think this kind of book is, because it's not designed for teaching, can often be rather challenging. A friend of mine was travelling on the train, a local train to Cambridge, and overheard two girls from the Hills Road Sixth Form College chatting away, and one of them said, so what are you reading then in history? Oh, it's Evans, one of them said. Yes, the other said, tough going, isn't it? You get really grateful when you get to one of the maps. So, nevertheless, I'm very grateful to teachers who set these books and hope that students get something from them, and I hope they'll get something from this new book as well. Thank you very much.